of the policy was a unity that could carry out the intent of the other faith. Now, let's go back and see what the public policy of Texas was. Under common law, before the first passage was written, I don't have the ability to say, that no in the religious, any business could not take from mother nor father. Then the statute was tempered somewhat and said they could take from mother only. And to me, the moment that statute was written, the discrimination was incorporated in. The answer appears to me, and the only logical thing would be as the criteria of evidence. Where you have conclusive evidence, then I think a legitimate suitcase, a legitimate suitcase. But here we don't go to that in this case, and that's the reason why I feel we are on good ground that the statute is unconstitutional, because this is by summary judgment. You don't know what the evidence is going to show on the trial of this case. It's a summary decision, and to me, the develop in favor of the public policy of Texas is on legitimate, this court has a unique opportunity. We ask you to sustain the decision of the Court of Civil Appeals and hold that our Constitution, even as it was written in 1960 under Grand Jury Board, as it existed in 1978 on June 2nd, when Warren Davis Jr. died, or as it is today. And we feel that the fact is unconstitutional and put at rest that matter as it exists in Texas. And I believe the Supreme Court would sustain it if it's written in that context. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. A rebuttal argument from petitioner.
Am I wrong? Is there not a statute of limitations on legitimacy proceedings? In effect, now, I understand the code and the code. How long has it been in effect? And it wasn't raised at either brief, and I didn't check it out, but when you've been arguing here, I've got the impression there is. Is it or is it or not?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, but I still can't answer this. I don't know.
Okay.
I think there's a 1-year statute to bring a paternity suit. Yeah, about the mother against that.
That's only
that's the very best that they have.
The question about the business of how far the inheritance through the father could go under the law of the city, I believe it says that under New York City, it says an illegitimate child is the legitimate child of the father. It says that he is reaching a gift from the father, the school is talking to the system, and during the lifetime of the father, in order to see the parents of paternity. And proceeding, instituted during the pregnancy of the mother over 2 years from the birth of the child.
That's the New York statute?
Yes, sir. I don't
know. Is that held in Lawley? Is that one? Is that held in Lawley?
That's in Lawley. Yes, sir. It doesn't say anything about the respiratory disease.
He can mention that only from the father. He doesn't mention it to the family.
Well, it doesn't say anything about the paternal affinity. It just says the father. And then, in the the father of an illegitimate child, this is Georgia law, the father of an illegitimate child may render the family legitimate by petitioning the superior court of the family of residence, putting forth the name, age, and sex of the child, and also the name of the mother, and if you desire to maintain, taking the new name and displaying the legitimation of the child. For this application, the mother is alive, still have notice. Upon such application, presented and filed, the court may pass an order to find such child to be legitimate and priesthood inherited from the Father in the same manner that it was born in the wedlock, and the name by which he or she to be known. And that's before we get a good understanding about the Trinity that we have about us to follow. Now, this farhand series, the council thinks that farhand series is not important. It's just a reverse, it's a condition, it's just a reverse. The farhand is the biological father, attempting to intercede and recover the part of the authority of the seed child. Of course, the same that starts with you starts with them, it works the same way. The principle, the same father, the law, is that the child tends to inherit from the biological father. One of the things that I think is also important to point out to the court, and that is that. And the Lapoon versus Benson, which is the Louisiana case, that was decided back in 1969, and Jeff Powell looked that thing in case, he pointed out very vividly that the first thing that Lapoon could have done to correct the situation was to let Temple will. And I say to the court that there's nothing wrong with reading the will. This is certainly one simple easy way. If the biological father is desirous of leaving a part of his estate, all of his estate is legitimate, a will will take care of it. And I have, as was pointed out a moment ago by one of you, adoption is not out of it's still in the book to no problem to adopt. So the Texas law all the way from the back to before the 1956 perfectly agreeable with the proposition that counsel points out that the gentleman ought to have equal protection. I agree. I say too, though, that everybody ought to have equal protection, and they ought not to pay the road in a do-or-die effort for illegitimate and let innocent families go top. It's a two-way street. The guidelines that have been set out by the Texas legislature are clear-cut and have passed, and the Supreme Court, in these later decisions, and for that matter, even Senate, has not cut top side and bottom the Texas law pertaining to this situation, and I see no reason why that we should at this time declare Section 42 of the probate code unconstitutional. We've got to have some kind of guidelines, and the legislature has done, I think, a tremendous job in trying to establish some guidelines. And without these guidelines, you have nothing short of chaos in the question of inheritance to intestate succession. And we've got to have something. We've got to have some way to protect innocent people. And if we're going to protect illegitimate, which I say that certainly we all can agree that we should, we've got to temper this with also protecting the families of these decedents also, who are equal now.
The case is submitted on written brief and oral arguments to both parties before the case is very brief.
I think this board was accusing the doctrine of non-therapeutic prescribing in that that if you believe that the undercover agent said everything, that the medications were not properly administered. What they were charging with, and what the business was, is not recognizing the undercover agents of what he did. The idea of being that someone who's been taking medications for a substance abuse would also do the same thing. But the problem in this case was, is that the, and then that's just what I'm doing from the question. The problem in this case is that only independent physicians testified. Clearly, they were simply too good. They said and did a lot of things. And the question remains whether or not they can everything they said, their diagnosis, whether it's a doctor's diagnosis, is reasonable. And the normal evidence in the case is that it was. If I have a minute to indicate that how these undercover agents operate. But to get back to you, to quickly get back to your question, you have the evidence that you have is number one, the evidence stated in the not the evidence, the fact finding, the evidence that supports the fact finding made in the United States that there's two persons, and that is this business about the PDR I don't the PDR was simply putting thrown into the record over my objection by Mr. Campbell. It wasn't sponsored by anybody. What the PDR had to say changes every year. The thing he's leading back to leading, if I'm not mistaken, was from a 1977 PDR, and the prescribing that Desmond Dawson did was in 1976. Each one of the doctors who testified that they didn't consider the PDR particularly authoritative. It wasn't put in the evidence. It really wasn't. It was just candid that's good in the record over my objection. But again, I would say that the best source of the
That's what these meditations are for, is to be the physician himself. He said the time. Mr. Campbell talked about the amount of the meditation which is required. Again, the only evidence in the record is that these meditations were prescribed in ordinary doses and over a long period of time. Pre-meeting was prescribed four times in 1976 to Mr. Richards. I believe the meditation rhythm was prescribed one time in 1976, one time in 1977, and six times in 1978, each time in ordinary doses. As I say, I would ultimately contend that the question is whether or not in this case, based upon everything that was said, the diagnosis of these positions was reasonable. I submit there's no evidence in the record at all that it was not. None. There's unanimous evidence that the medical people said it was. If for some reason the board felt that it was non-therapeutic, other than just the maybe they, I don't see why they would have any problem putting a medical person, just as I did, on the phone and tell me why, so I could cross-examine that they did not do that. And so I say that, and it's a case, fact finding must be based on evidence and audit. I believe that the audit is not to prove about substantial evidence based on evidence and record.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted on the brief and the oral argument. That concludes the business of the court. The marshal will adjourn the court. Prince Tommy, or the livelier, who testified at the trial that before the foreclosure occurred of the HMC deed itself, that they had been informed that the agent did that. There's no evidence in the record that they had any way changed their position at that time, that they could not come in and rescind that transaction by refunding the money that they received as a reverse transfer. Now, we submit that, as has been argued, that they shouldn't be able to have their case and eat it through, to set up a situation where they got a substantial amount of money and can now get their property back by simply disregarding what the agent did in order to get the money that they received. There is argument made that HMC knew that there was no authority to execute that subordination. As I read the brief, the argument centers on the fact that there is a handwritten statement attached to one of the closing statements that says lively errors and so many dollars. There's nothing in there that states what the purpose of that money was, and looking at the record, I think that the jury should well have believed that there was no knowledge on the part of HMC, and that there was evidence in which they should believe that. Even though there is authority, as Mr. Tipper has added to the court, that the knowledge would not prevent the ratification. And we simply think that there was, before the court, evidence indeed in the light most favorable to the jury's answer to that issue to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The argument from Ms. Thomas.
So, please report. My name is Rick Addison. I'm with the firm of Story, Armstrong, Cleaver, and Martin. With me today is Mr. Keith Cleaver of our firm, and we represent the respondents. Before moving on to the substance and merits of the lawsuit, there is one minor factual statement that needs to be corrected. The loan made from AT&T Realty Company was made to Entertain Properties, Inc., which is a controlled corporation of Leon B. Hall. The reason for the question is to make clear later in the argument. The issue of ratification is an affirmative defense on which the defendants have the burden to plead, submit proper special issues, and prove their case in order to obtain a verdict. We contend that they have failed miserably in each of these respects. Pursuant to Rule 94 and to the case of Petroleum Anchor versus Tyra, ratification must be pleaded. Nowhere in AT&T's answer is there a pleading of ratification. The transcript, page 54. AT&T has attempted, after the fact, to rely on the pleadings of Southwest Land Title Company and defended Hogg for their pleading. Each of these parties pleaded ratification, but at the time of submission of the case to the jury, Hogg had a directed verdict against him and had been removed from the primary cause. Southwest Land Title Company, at page 180 of the transcript, announced to the court and found the record that they had settled their dispute with AT&T Realty Company. They didn't ask for any issues. They never asserted a pleading against the plaintiff, the respondent here, and the primary cause of action.
So objections to the action to plead?
Yes, sir. Those are properly preserved, and I'd be happy to present the court with the proper citation. Even if these two parties are still viewed as being in the case at the point of submission to the charge, there was no formal adoption of the pleading, and we would submit that it would be an incorrect rule to have the third-party plaintiff benefit from the pleadings of their adversary, the third-party defendant. It seems to fly in the face of adversarial proof. I would cite to the court the case of MVM Incorporated versus St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company, which is a federal court case. Rule 14 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is yet classically the same as Rule 38 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. In this case, it says that for the primary defendant, the third-party plaintiff, to benefit from the third-party defendant's pleading, the third-party defendant must assert the cause of action over against the plaintiff in the primary cause of action. I might also note to the court that there is a host of conflicting authorities that's not nearly as enlightening. Likewise, the petitioner fails to submit appropriate special issues on the question of ratification. Three special issues were submitted to the court. The first two inquired the special issues number 4 and 5. They inquire as to the knowledge of the respondent at the time of the down payment. In these instances, the question was asked, did the respondent or did the plaintiff have knowledge of the subordination at the time they received the down payment, and did the plaintiffs have knowledge of where the proceeds came from at the time of the down payment? In each instance, the jury answered they did not. They answered that their agent did have knowledge, but that the plaintiffs did not. And the fact that defendants have failed in their burden to submit other special issues on the controlling questions of retention of benefits as ratification falls under their burden, and we think they have failed in that respect. Secondly, with regards to special issues, special issue number 6 addresses the question of whether or not the plaintiffs ratified the actions of their agent, R.B. Russell, in executing the subordination of the loan agreement. A proper objection was made to the definition that's contained in that special issue, and particularly the last line of it, where the statement is made that an affirmance of an unauthorized act may be inferred by a failure to repudiate it. Now, we objected to this on the transcript for the reason that it presumes knowledge. It presumes that the plaintiff had knowledge of the subordination, and there's no evidence to support it at the time. We would also contend that this is comes straight within the province of the case of Ruth v. Medlock versus Medlock, which is a very old yet principal Supreme Court case, and also the old uncited case of the Texarkana Court of Civil Appeals, which is Clark and Boyce Lumber Company versus Duncan. Turning to the substance of ratification, we understand that it is a creature of equity, that it is the affirmance of a previously unauthorized act, and as was stated by this court in the case of Fraser versus Wynn, there can be no ratification or estoppel from acceptance of the benefit by a person who did not have knowledge of all the material facts. We are not contending here, and we have not contended, that the respondents did not retain the $467,000 down payment amount. It's clear that they did, but the record undisputedly says that they had no knowledge of the subordination at the time they received these terms, and that full knowledge of the original transaction and of the material facts was not gained until some 2 years later, a matter of days before the foreclosure. Petitioners have argued throughout, and they've argued this morning, that retention of benefits is ipso facto ratification once the principal acquires knowledge. We would submit that this standard is appropriate in dealing with the receipt of benefits when one has prior or contemporaneous knowledge, but that when one retains the benefits initially and later acquires knowledge, that's no act of affirming. That's no manifestation of affirming. If we could look, for example, at the instance where one gets knowledge beforehand of the unauthorized act, and then he accepts payments or benefits, it's clear that by accepting those payments or benefits, he is manifesting that he understands what has occurred and he's going to accept the benefits. In the instance of one retaining the benefits initially, unknowingly, and then later acquiring knowledge of all the material facts, the acquisition of knowledge standing by itself is not a manifestation of an affirmance. This is why we return to section 99 of the statement.
What should the person do?
Well, we would submit, Your Honor, that some sort of repudiation should take place, and we think that occurred in this case by a filing suit. As the record reflects, in 1975, we found out about the unauthorized acts of our agents in the summer of 1975, when we found out. In August of 1975, this suit was filed.
Did you return to the
No, sir. We have never rescinded the money. And in looking to the restatement, particularly comment C of section 99, it states that a principal retention of the benefits of an unauthorized act does not constitute ratification if its position is so changed that it is inequitable to require the return of these items under some sort of circumstances.
Well, isn't that then a little question?
Yes, sir.
What are the jury? What is the jury found? How would you interpret that particular question?
Well, the jury doesn't speak to the question of ratification by retention of benefits with the options of the honor, and there were no issues submitted on that. The broad issue of ratification that was submitted by the petitioners addressed just whether they had ratified it in any form or fashion with knowledge to them.
Well,
it might, yes, sir.
That's what the petitioners are saying.
Yes, sir. Well, we think the standard that petitioners are suggesting is an incorrect standard, in that they are arguing that by retaining the benefits and then acquiring knowledge, you have automatically ratified the transaction.
But the seven messages change the position?
Well, we would argue that it is inequitable to require the return under these circumstances, and the reasons for that I'm about to present. Court, please.
Yeah, I have a question to you and your colleagues. It was lucky to have an illustration of one that is inequitable to acquire or assign something to which you have no right, or whatever.
Well, we would contend that our right to the down payment, if that's what we're considering to be the benefits that have been retained, stems from our contract with Mr. Hall when we sold him the land. As the restatement suggests, there is a balancing test under the court of equity that has to be considered when one retains benefits and then gets subsequent knowledge.
Are there any proper illustrations you could give?
Well, we would, of course, contend that this case is an excellent illustration of
it.
Yes, sir. Well, no, we don't think it's simple, but we think it's a good illustration of it. There are a variety of things that need to be taken into consideration, such as whether or not one party knew the agent was authorized or not, whether or not they attempted to conceal the transaction. When, at what point in time, did the principal obtain full knowledge? All of those are matters within the comment C to section 99 of the statement should be balanced. It seems to us that we're here in the heart of equity, and the relative knowledge and duties and burdens of the parties have to be considered. Now, at trial, we had no oral testimony from AT&T Realty Company representatives. We do have two very revealing documents which indicate their knowledge of the unauthorized act of our purported agents. Those two documents are AT&T Realty Company Exhibit Number 8 and Number 21. AT&T Realty Company Exhibit Number 8 of this birth receipt to which the petitioners referred. On the back of that is attached a signed dispersal plan, which was followed and is confirmed by the church, which showed that none of this money ever went to improving the construction, and that AT&T Realty Company knew it at the time. Secondly, the escrow agreement, which is AT&T Exhibit Number 21, indicates that this $363,000 of this proposed improving the construction loan went into an escrow account to service the debt installment of Mr. Hogg's company, Innocent Property Inc., in their borrowing from AT&T Realty Company. We would suggest to the court that this indicates not only that AT&T Realty Company had knowledge of the unauthorized acts of the agent, but also that they had knowledge at the time of the closing. Moreover, we would suggest that in this balancing test to determine basically who should bear the burden of this transaction, that these matters should be considered along with such other matters as how long a time had elapsed, 2 years had elapsed, before full knowledge was gained. Moreover, the conscious inaccuracy in the labeling of the documents as an improvement and development loan, as an improvement and construction loan, in light of the fact, known to AT&T at the time, that these funds were not going to be used for that purpose, certainly must bear heavily on their equitable position. Well, our position, Your Honor, is that we had no knowledge of this until 2 years down the road. Yes, sir, I understand we still do. The policy decision, I guess, the equitable policy decision that we would submit to the court to be followed is that.
Are any of the illustrations in the restatement kind of simple?
Yes, sir. There's one illustration.
I don't mean to pick it up.
Yes,
this is a hard case in there, but
yes,
I'm real good with it. If you've been working with two, 3 years,
yes,
and you have.
The most simple example can be found in number 7 and 8 to section 99. There the example is given, and this is much simpler than ours, that if a person owns his stock, say 100 shares, he sold it, he authorized his agent to sell it, his agent went out and sold it, and then the principal retained the proceeds unknowingly and found out, I think it says 11 months or 1 year later, that his finding out at that time would not constitute ratification. Period. That's simple an example. Our example, we would submit, is much more supportive of our positions than even that very simple example. And the policy, Your Honor, that you have alluded to, the equitable policy, the broad one that we would suggest the court follow is that the conscious, inaccurate labeling of these instruments, the machinations to which both AT&T Realty Company, Mr. Hogg, and our agents endured in order to get this loan and get this money was a business risk. They were trying to get the land for the price of $400,000. But it was clear that Hogg was going to, from the record, that Hogg didn't have any funds, he was not searching for the funds. They loaned him the money, they styled it an improvement in construction loan when they knew it wasn't, and that there should be a policy against this kind of machination. Briefly, we'd like to address the argument put forth by petitioners to the third point of the Court of Civil Affairs of Dallas, that we stand here trying to discipline part of our transaction while affirming the benefit of having our case and eating it too. As the Court of Civil Appeals accurately stated in distinguishing the Overholster case, the petitioners have erroneously assumed that the respondents that the livelihoods are entitled to this money only because of the unauthorized acts of our agents. In fact, the record reflects that the plaintiffs are entitled to retain the down payment from Hogg precisely because of their contract with him, not because of their contact or their agent's contact with AT&T Realty Company. The record reflects that none of our people ever met anyone from AT&T Realty Company. The record further reflects that Russell was not only our agent, he was also the agent of Innocent Properties Inc. He formed that corporation with Mr. Hall. He was its secretary, he was its director. He represented them at the closing and was paid a fee. He found Hogg's loan. There's undisputed testimony by the witness Hogg that he found the loan. We would submit that when Russell, who was our agent, and we admit he was our agent for limited purposes, was out gathering in this loan, he wasn't acting necessarily in our best interest. He was acting on the interest of his other principal, Mr. Hogg. He represented him. He went and got the loan. the crucial point about Hogg and Interchange Property Inc. is that the loan was made to Interchange. The land was sold to Hogg. We sold our land to Mr. Hogg. We didn't know anything about Interchange Property Inc. Interchange Property Inc. was formed, the land was being transferred to it so that the loan could be made to Interchange Property Inc. and could be secured by that loan.
Is there any evidence that or finding that the heirs were unable to return the money?
No, sir. No, sir. There's no evidence as to that except as to the inferential that the time has passed and that it's been separated between the heirs or commingled or spent. But there's no finding as to it.
And no testimony, I take it, that put this in an illiquid asset that they could
not? No, sir. No, sir, there's not. We might also add there, of course, that the burden to produce that testimony is under the plaintiff's trial and petitioner's here. To submit, as the petitioner is doing, that this involves a question of good conscience and equity is entirely clear, that the case does not involve a group of plaintiffs who are retaining $400,000 and now legally seek their land back. Rather, it involves a group of plaintiffs who receive $400,000 in down payment for the sale of their property to an individual, unknowing of the fact that their first lien had been illegally subordinated to what was ultimately a purchase money mortgage. It also involves a defendant, AT&T Realty Company, which has itself retained $363,000 out of the alleged improvement and construction loan, labeled that the substance of their something else. Clearly, this is a case where it is not only inequitable for the plaintiff to be required to return the down payment, but is equally inequitable for AT&T Realty Company to retain the land. Petitioners are relying on defenses which are historically grounded in the court of equity. As a matter of fact, it is clear that the petitioners not only have knowledge of the material facts involved in the transaction, but that they orchestrated parts of it to their benefit, unbeknownst to the financially less sophisticated plaintiff. As a matter of law, petitioners now seek to reverse the judgment of the appeals court by relying on non-existent pleadings, improper special issues, and evidence which fails to carry their burden. And it is for this reason that the respondents respectfully pray that the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals be affirmed and the judgment be rendered on behalf of the respondents. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The deferred arguments and assignment. The rebuttal arguments and petition. May it please the court, I would like to address a number of the responses which have been made by the lottery heirs. Firstly, as we were pleading on ratification, it is true in this case that ratification was pled by Chapter Title, but not pled by ACC Realty Company. Now, under the argument of the lottery heirs, those things which are stated, we take exception to this for two basic reasons. First, purpose of Rule 94, which deals with affirmative defenses, which ratification is to give notice. While Southwest Title had pled ratification, the lottery heirs knew that it was faithful, they had notice of what was coming. Second basis, the second argument that we've been put forward on the lack of pleading of ratification on the part of ACC Realty Company is the fact that we got this title for a third-party defendant. Now, under Rule 38 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, a third-party defendant may assert any defenses which the third-party plaintiff has to the plaintiff's claim. So if ACC Realty has a defense to the plaintiff's claim, it can be asserted by a third-party defendant, which in this case was Southwest Title. Now, the Texas courts have never addressed the question of whether or not the third-party defendant's pleadings were near to the benefit of the third-party plaintiff. Now, this has been addressed by the federal court under Rule 14, which is
for the most part, essentially the same as our Rule 38. In the case of Newton versus New York Life Insurance Company, the court held that by reason of the fact that this defense had been raised by the third party defendant, the defense, if successful, will, under the provisions of Rule 14A of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, accrue to the benefit of the defendant, even though that defendant has specifically refrained from raising the defense itself. But that contention is our Southwest title will inure to the benefit of ATC Realty Company as the first failure to plead the application as no bearing in this case. The second response I would like to address is their contention that there was no issue, only intention by the rival heirs of the $472,000. That's correct, there was no issue because it was undisputed. We have no burden to submit special issues on fact issues which are undisputed. In this case, it was undisputed that the plaintiff kept the $472,000. Third, they try to finish this case in the case where the principal received the benefit at a time when he has knowledge of the unauthorized act. And they say it only applies in that type of case, but does not apply in the case where the principal has no knowledge when he receives the benefit. Well, that is not an accurate statement of the law. I'd like to again read out of Texas jurisprudence, and it cites a number of cases under it, which says, as a general rule, ratification is established where it appears that the principal, although having no knowledge originally of the circumstances attending the unauthorized act of the agent, nevertheless retain the benefits of the transaction after acquiring full knowledge thereof. Fourth argument I'd like to address deals with change of position. There was no evidence at all presented at the trial of this case of any change of position on the part of the rival. It's our contention that once we establish legislation, if they want to avoid the effect of this affirmative defense, it's their burden, it's their issue to get a finding on the change of position.